And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I'm Phil Taylor. Phil Conlon is back from the West Coast. How are you doing?
I'm good. Happy to be here.
Today we're going to talk to Professor Edward Herman. He is the co-author, together with Noam Chomsky, of a, I think everybody regards as a classic, published in 1988, The Manufacturing Consent. His latest book is The Politics of Genocide with David Peterson. Both very profound books, in my opinion. And Edward Herman is going to be talking to us about another book, which is seems to be enjoying a lot of popularity, discussion by Professor Stephen Edwards. Stephen Pinker. Stephen Edwards. Yes, that's a Toronto journalist. Not a bad guy, but Stephen Pinker, who's written a book. Gotten a lot of attention, and we'll be talking to Ed Herman about this, because Ed Herman has written an article for Zed Magazine, and if you're listening in the United States, Z Magazine. You can go to zcommunications.org to find a copy of this article. It's titled Stephen Pinker on the Triumph of Angels, and it's a very curious book. The title is taken from the first inaugural address of Abraham Lincoln, where he said he appealed to the South to listen to the better angels of our nature to avoid war. And, of course, after that, they had a war, and 600,000 people got killed. But anyway, that was chosen as the title. We are joined now, I believe, by Edward Herman. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. And you could speak louder too, Phil.
I'll do my best, Ed.
Okay.
And if, and by the way, don't hesitate if you don't hear something, just shout, tell me to shout, and I'll do it.
Okay.
You have written an article for Z Magazine. We have to make our two in Canada. We say Z, but titled Stephen Pinker on the Triumph of Angels. And this, your article caught my attention because I have, every time I turn on the television, for about 6-8 weeks, he seemed to be on everybody's talk show. He's become a celebrity author. He has written quite a tome. I understand 800 pages long. I am not claiming to have read it. I did not. But he has a thesis which you have criticized, and others have spoken up about. It seems to be a book which is trying to say that while we have violence and we have wars, actually we are progressing. Humanity is progressing. I'd like to know, first of all, why is this book getting the attention it is?
Well, he is arguing that violence is down. And I think that the pundits, the politicians, love to hear that because they're under a lot of pressure. I mean, budgets are being strained by military spending, and a lot of people have the impression that wars and militarism are on the increase. And here comes Pinker saying that things are improving, that violence is down. So it's kind of a PR plus for the establishment to make soften people up a bit. The violence is down. Why you have to be more tolerant of these military expenditures and military ventures. They're less than things were. This is an era. He calls it an era of the greatest peace. Amazing.
Yes, you cite, you point out that the New York Times gave him a flattering front page Sunday book review by the philosopher Peter Singer, and he called the book supremely important. Now, as you point out, Mr. Pinker isn't the first guy to be talking about this. There are a number of books which are discussing whether or not the U.S., for example, with its bases abroad and its huge military is heading down a road of increasing violence and brutality with little anecdotes like the one coming from Afghanistan today, major writers. But what does Pinker say about these people, such as Chalmers Johnson, for example?
Well, Chalmers Johnson has written three very good books in the last decade on the rise of militarism. And Chalmers Johnson argues that the military has more or less taken over, that the institution of the military and permanent war is at a peak, and it's really threatening. Well, I'll tell you, how does Pinker handle that? He doesn't mention Chalmers Johnson. He doesn't mention this Andrew Bacevich, who's another pretty distinguished commentator who writes books on U.S. militarism. He bypasses the whole subject. He refuses to discuss it. These are very distinguished authors. So he's using what I like to call the preferential method of research. That is, he has a huge collection of footnotes and citations, but they're all the people that he prefers. So he just ignores Chalmers Johnson. It's really actually quite, it's almost amusing.
It's a sort of a circular argument. It's like the professor who quotes his PhD students or the other members of his own department. What about this? I notice that he introduces a word which really usually alerts people that we might have a problem. He uses the word civilization, and he speaks of the centers, I guess, of London, Britain, I'd have to assume London, Paris, Washington, as the more civilized. I don't. Does he make that distinction? I know that the word comes is part of his the thesis, his vocabulary.
Yeah, he talks about civilization and decivilization and a civilizing process, and he does. He is, he's a Western nationalist, he's a U.S. nationalist and patriot, and he finds the virtues in the West, the United States, and East and Europe, and I'm sure he would throw Canada into the hopper, too. These are the civilized areas, and the main thesis of his idea, his main thesis on the reduction of violence, is that among these democratic great powers, there hadn't been war since the Second World War. So this is a great era of peace. It's, of course, he starts out with a wonderful base. I mean, the World War II, he starts there. But World War II was one of the most violent wars and costly wars in history. So he makes that to be kind of an exception, and he'll use that as a base. And so after that...
When things are quiet, they're very quiet.
yeah, after that, the big powers didn't fight one another. Of course, then maybe they saw that they were still recovering from the cost of World War II. But... He ignores the fact that while they didn't fight among themselves, they did fight with a lot of little countries. They picked on a stream of little countries, including the Vietnam and up to Libya, Iraq, etc. So there have been a huge number of wars, but they're not wars between the big democracies. Therefore, this is an age of peace. I mean, that's a long piece. That's an amazing line of argument.
Now, what do you make of it? He claims to me that he's doing this, that all he's doing is following the data. In other words, he's not interested in the politics, the ideology, history. He's just looking at the numbers. And he says you just see a decline in violence. What do you make of that kind of argument? What's he up to there?
Well, he's very shifty on numbers. He sometimes said, talking about violence falling over a very long time period, like from the caveman. So between the caveman and the present, violence has fallen. And sometimes he uses numbers on things like homicides. But and when he uses numbers on wars, he frequently will just talk about the wars between the great powers. has a lot of tricks in handling numbers. He's got a lot of numbers, but they almost always are problematic for you. He loves sources which when they talk about wars, talk about battle deaths, not the deaths of people who are civilians. I do believe that his reliance on numbers involves tremendous amount of manipulation. I mean, just this business of this being an era of long peace because the great powers haven't fought one another. What the numbers there, if they're totally distorted because of a lot of little powers that are getting beaten up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I watched some of his interviews, and he seemed, by the way, rather touchy. he talks this way. On the matter of torture, he, of course, brings out that, you know, there used to be the rack, and there used to be burning people, and they're pulling nails, etc. And so then he says, but today, you know, the torture is rather mild by comparison. I don't understand where he's going. I mean, you're talking about torture, right? So it's kind of almost like a debater's trick. Is it torture right now, or isn't it?
Yeah, that is very tricky. As a matter of fact, it's a thing that I've cited a couple of times in my own writings, that torture had actually declined pretty steadily for several hundred years. And then in the 1970s, 60s, especially the 70s and after, it grew. There was Amnesty International put out a report on torture. I think it was back in 1974 when they pointed out that torture, which had declined for years, had taken on a new life. And even after the death of Stalin, they're very explicit that it was happening in the free world. And the greatest place where torture was happening was in Latin America. There were a whole bunch of national security states like Chile and Guatemala came into existence under U.S. sponsorship, and torture became really a big business again. And of course, torture has been important in the war against terror. I mean, in Guantanamo, and in these extraordinary renditions, there's torture. And torture is part of the business, and it's been defended. You have the official defenses by George Bush and Cheney, and of waterboarding and these other things are perfectly okay. So actually, you can make a good case that in Pinker's lifetime, torture has taken on a new life and has become a more established phenomenon. He pulls tricks like that all the time. One thing that's, I think, very interesting is he says one evidence of the decline of violence is the extent to which chemical and biological warfare are considered to be no-no. But he doesn't mention that during the Vietnam War, the United States used chemical warfare on a huge scale. They even had a program called Operation Ranch Hand, which was a program to defoliate rice crops of Vietnamese peasants because the Vietnamese resistance was using those crops to eat, was eating some of those crops. So here you have the United States itself engaging in a massive chemical warfare program that's left thousands and hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese deformed. There was a Wall Street Journal article in 1997 that was an amazing article that claimed that there were 500,000 Vietnamese who had suffered deformities from our chemical warfare. But here's Pinker talks about the decline, that this is evidence of the diminution in violence, that chemical warfare is down. He never mentions that the United States used chemical warfare in Vietnam. I think that really is, that's a little disturbing scholarship.
But you exactly. You use the word apologetic. It seems, you know, it works so nicely if it dovetails with U.S. policy. I mean, that we here we have a president, another Harvard man, but who and our and the Prime Minister of Canada both now speak in this ugly way about, well, we don't really like torture. That means we're civilized. But on the other hand, we think enhanced interrogation techniques have to be used.
Yeah.
I mean, if he wants to use the word civilized, if he wants to see a symptom of somebody who's kind of losing his grip, you would think two leaders of semi-power, well, one's a medium power, the other's a great power, talking now in a way that we've never heard. I've never heard an American president talk like that previous.
Yeah, it's pretty it's an amazing scene that so many ugly things have been institutionalized and legalized. And in fact, I argue that Obama has made the world, the whole globe, a free fire zone. He's announced that that we can shoot terrorists or anybody we choose to go after. We can go after without them being tried in a court of law. I mean, this is making the world a free fire zone.
Yeah, no, you would think, I mean, the whole issue is, are we becoming more civilized? Professor Steven Pinker, author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. At the very time when a president says, yes, we can assassinate whomever we like, including U.S. citizens, you would, as I think somebody did say to him recently, don't you think you might get laughed at? Because this kind of, we need exactly the opposite analysis at this moment from people who have with prestigious positions such as Mr. Pinker to explain why do we have a president who speaks this way? Why do we have an American Congress who seems to think it'd be fun to have a war on with a major country in the Middle East?
Yeah, it's almost laughable. But on the other hand, you can see why they need Pinker. They need a cover. They need somebody who's going to say, in spite of all these seeming increases in forms of violence and threats of violence, it's really less than it used to be. We're in an era of the long peace. It's actually pretty Orwellian, you might say.
Let me just remind everybody, we are speaking to Professor Edward Herman. The article is Steven Pinker on the Triumph of Angels, and it's in Z Magazine, zcommunications.org, a major contribution. I just want to say this. He could have written this book, you know, if you just follow his reasoning, he could have written the book the day after the bombs dropped on, the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, right? He could have said, well, that's bad, but, you know, Genghis Khan would have really made a mess of the place.
Yes, also, we'll start measuring from here on. we won't include Hiroshima. He brushes past Hiroshima like he brushes past World War II. He gives it very cursory treatment, although here you had a single man, Harry Truman, deciding to wipe out, and in the end, wiping out a quarter of a million civilians in a couple of days. I mean, that's a pretty amazing performance.
And the civilized state that did that actually has never gotten around to saying they thought that was a mistake, did they?
No, I don't think there's ever been an apology, or they actually covered it up for a long time in the sense that they wouldn't allow pictures to be shown that they were taken at the site. But they got away with mass murder. Mm-hmm. The amazing thing is how something like that, you just compare that with, say, what happened in Bosnia. In Bosnia, the Western establishment has been shrieking about genocide in Bosnia. The total number of people, of civilians killed in Bosnia in the 1992 to 95, the total number of civilians killed was under 50,000. And here you have 250,000 killed by Harry Truman in a couple of days. Yeah. Or, but the sanctions of mass destruction in Iraq that Bill Clinton imposed, there may have been a million Iraqis died with that famous incident on national television where Madeleine Albright was asked whether 500,000 dead children as a result of these sanctions wasn't a little much, and she said it was worth it. It was worth it.
Yeah. You know, as I read what you've had to say and listened a bit to Steven Pinker talking, he might even agree with her. I don't know. But does he? I don't know if he did, if he ever addressed that. But there are so many instances of cold-blooded decision-making in our own times. I can recall that Lyndon Johnson said to his troops, I want you to go and nail that coonskin to the wall. I know what he thought he was talking about. It didn't sound very civilized. But on that subject, in your article, you point out that Mr. Pinker's view of the Vietnam War is that all those casualties had to be, you start with the responsibility of fanatical governments or fanatical leaderships in the Viet Cong, I guess you would say, or the North Koreans. And He puts the onus on them.
That's the most amazing, and it shows where Pinker is and who Pinker is. I mean, a man who could say that the deaths, civilian deaths. First of all, he talks about 800,000 civilian battle deaths, as if 800,000 civilians were killed in battles. But he also has this amazing statement that the fanatical Vietnamese failed to stop fighting despite the fact that they were absorbing tremendous casualties. So their fanaticism, what he says, fueled the Vietnam War. So the United States didn't do it. We may have dropped the bombs and directly killed them, but it was the Vietnamese who resisted. They didn't surrender to superior power.
They made us do it. Yeah, I mean, they made us do it.
That is amazing. I mean, to say that the Vietnamese were responsible for the deaths of the millions that died in the Vietnam War by this country crossing the ocean and dropping all those bombs and napalm, that's apologetics for home country violence that could not be exceeded.
Mm-hmm. We want to remind everybody that this is a gentleman who's getting, frankly, star treatment. There's a lot of major commentators and whatnot are saying this is the go-to book. I want to ask you that he himself has favorite writers and people, and you cite, for example, that he goes to James Sheehan, whose theme in Where Have All the Soldiers Gone, The Transformation of Modern Europe, is that Europeans have changed their conception of the state and that now they're no longer interested in violence. So the soldiers have gone. There are some soldiers over there, aren't there?
Sheehan. Of course, he's talking about Europe, but Pinker is quoting him, and presumably he believes that the state has abandoned, more or less abandoned violence, and is just pursuing the welfare of the population, which is what Sheehan says. But this is an obvious baloney. I mean, the welfare states are being diminished and shrunken by the United States and the Canadian government and the European government are all working austerity programs, and their military budgets and their wars continue. So, I mean, this is just a myth structure. Essentially, it's Orwellian. He's effectively protecting the violent state by claiming that violence went down and that the states are now just interested in public welfare. I mean,
And here we have situations that several other critics have pointed out. You have this increasing violence in a country like Greece, which are experiencing economic crisis, and then you have this phenomenon of the gentleman in the killer in Norway. He's very touchy about that because a couple of people pointed out that that kind of violence, domestic violence, and he calls that, I think he used the word random, but if he was a political scientist, would be interested in what are people talking about in Europe that would cause a guy to target a group of people with a thesis, an Islamophobic thesis. And maybe it was Kristallnacht, for example, just a random moment?
Well, he even has the World War II as a random moment. It's an offbeat.
Just a miscalculation.
But he, another really important thing is that he quotes this guy Sheehan, who we mentioned, talking about the pursuit of the welfare of ordinary people, which is, as I say, baloney. But it's actually more than baloney. You could argue, one thing, when he talks about violence, Pinker is never talking about economic violence. He's never talking about social violence. Well, sometimes he is, but he certainly does not talk about how ordinary people can be injured by tax policy and by the export of jobs and by union busting, and by the diminution of the welfare state, so that people are not helped very much when they get in trouble. We call this structural violence, and it's a very important thing. This man, Amartya Sen, the economist, has made a famous comparison between India and China, where he points out that in India, in I think about 69 to 79, he believes that there are 100 million people died in India because of starvation, malnutrition, disease, poor medical care. And he actually compares that in China, that there were millions killed as a result of a famine under the communist regime. And of course, Pinker focuses on what happened in China, but he never would mention something like what Sen is talking about in India and in other parts of the world, where vast numbers of people may die because they're not cared for, because the state ignores them. China, even Sen points out that China, in spite of that famine, did much better than India for a long, long time, even under the bad guy Mao, because they did have a powerful welfare system, whereas India had a poor one for those years. Anyway, the point is that structural violence is extremely important in the world and kills vast numbers of people, but it's outside of Pinker's orbit of concern.
Could you elaborate on that, the structural violence, what that means?
It means injury to people based on the structures of the system and the policies of the leaders of the system. It actually can overlap with regular violence. In fact, during the 1960s and there were many documents in Latin America by the church pointing out of how the military regimes had caused anguish and pain and death to many, many people because they made it impossible for them to organize, and they destroyed unions in the interest of the elite and the foreign companies that wanted to go into, say, Brazil. So these church documents, one of them was called The Cry of the People, and it was about the extent to which the people of Brazil were marginalized and they were hungry. They couldn't organize. The state didn't help them. So, and the army, the military regime that took over in 64 enforced this by making it impossible for unions to organize. So this was a form of structural violence. These people were suffering a kind of violence by the behavior of the dominant corporations and the government supporting them. That was the military regime. But in my opinion, that's what's going on in the world in general. That's what's going on in Canada and the United States and Great Britain, where they're imposing austerity programs and stripping down the welfare state and causing a lot of people to suffer. And this, I argue, this is a form of class warfare. Mm-hmm. And class warfare is a form of structural violence. I think that this is, of course, this is of crucial importance.
And it has its obvious passionate and advocates, such as Hillary Clinton, who in two regimes now has been very much for starving people out. I mean, the policy they're bringing to bear now on Syria and that directed toward Iran is calculated, as they say, to create pain.
That's the purpose of these policies, but these policies are carried out at home. That's the amazing thing.
Yes, but by the way, on that point, I swear I saw him saying that the reduction of crime, because U.S. has had a somewhat of a, I don't know the numbers, but you know, a diminution of crime, I guess. And he says, well, you know, that's taking people off the streets. And he uses the example he says people complain that, well, you know, young men have been arrested, charged with drug trafficking, when in fact they didn't or weren't. And he says, yes, but you see, in that scooping of those individuals, some of them were violent individuals. You get a reduction of violence.
Yes.
Although, by the way, he doesn't comment on violence in prisons, which is somewhat legendary in the United States.
Yes, that's a very good point. The prison violence is quite remarkable. In fact, the New York Times yesterday, and amazingly yesterday or today, had an article on the use of isolation wards in some big prison, I think maybe in Mississippi, and large numbers of people were confined in isolation, and they've decided that, and many of them went mad. It's really a form of torture.
It's the old concept known in the slave South of breaking people, right? Breaking.
Yeah. Yes.
And breaking is a mental exercise.
Yeah, but the prison system is a reflection of the structural violence. An awful lot of people in poor communities, black people, have no job opportunities. They're isolated. The job market is for them is extremely poor. They go into drugs, and so they get arrested. The whole system is biased, and of course, even in enforcing drug laws, you probably are aware of the fact that there's a difference between there various forms of crack powder, crack cocaine,
yes, white cocaine and black cocaine.
Yeah, and the cocaine that is used by white people involves much less serious prison sentences than the other kind of cocaine. I mean, you have a structural bias that makes for a greater black prison population, and in any case, the prison system, as you say, is itself a form of violence. But how people get there is, and the vast numbers that we have in the over two million in the United States, this reflects a structural violence in which large numbers of people are put in such an economic position that they commit crimes. argues that this is to some a good extent a biological phenomenon. He talks about a kind of a normal number, an expected, I forget the exact word he used, for and the people who were designed for prison but for biological reasons, which is really has a real racist touch to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I notice you point out that he sort of walks up to that and then he says, but we don't need that to make our point.
Yeah.
He says it could be, but it's sort of like he's thinking, well, maybe I could get in hot water with that one. We're speaking to Ed Herman, and we really appreciate all this time. But I want to ask you, he introduces the idea, and I wonder if this is linked to what's going on today with NATO and all that, of the Leviathan. He said, well, Hobbes may have right about the Leviathan. You need a state, a civilized state, I guess. Take care of all the violence so that everybody else can just go about their business. Is that how do you think that's how maybe he views a phenomenon like NATO? First of all, they're containing communism. Communism goes away, and then NATO gets bigger and meaner. I guess he would say, well, they have is that a civilizing mission he thinks they're on?
NATO?
I get that impression from your assessment of him, that he is seeing NATO... I don't know if he ever explicitly discusses it, but as a civilizing mission, certainly the President of the United States and others talk about it that way.
Well, I think that maybe Pinker thinks that. Pinker certainly thinks the West is the good guys and the communists are the bad guys. So the West, during the Cold War, the United States was containing the communists. And now... Because there is a problem with the communist, the Soviet Union gone. In fact, this is a very big question. If the better angels are taking over, and the better angels, we had a lot of armaments to contain the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union is gone. Why do armaments keep growing? Why does NATO have to expand? I guess... It is consistent with his view that there could be a civilizing mission, and of course that's what NATO claims, that it's enlarged its area coverage because of the threats of terrorism and so on. NATO doesn't say because of threats of the uncivilized. That's Pinker's notion, but it fits Pinker's mode of thought. That the superior culture would be out there establishing law and order and trying to civilize the rest of the world that has lacked this civilization.
Yes. And he introduces a point which you took up very nicely in your essay. By the way, again, that's in Z Magazine, Steven Pinker on the Triumph of Angels. He's very inspired that the United States Marine Corps has a code of ethics.
Yeah, this is another thing that in Pinker that's absolutely amazing. He cites a Marine Corps code of ethics that actually declares that the protection of human life is an aspiration, and that it's all life, that we want to not just protect our own soldiers and so on, but all people. This is in the Marine Code. And Pinker cites this as demonstration. He admits that it's only an aspiration. He says that it shows that the Western code of morality in fighting wars has improved, because here you have this Marine code of ethics. It's absolutely breathtaking that somebody would take this Marine code of ethics and take it as, first for one thing, it's a genuine aspiration as opposed to just a code.
Well, you point out, by the way, the U.S. Army, and by the way, the Marines have had this code a long time. I took it myself. But the U.S. Army has had this. And actually, I'm going to guess that most of the armies in the world actually do have such codes.
Yes, I think so. The Soviet,
it's not new.
The Soviet Union had a freedom of speech. They had a constitution which gave the total freedom of speech. But Tinkerman did not say that Soviet free speech thing.
He wouldn't call that an aspiration. He would call that a lie.
No, he wouldn't. That's right. He wouldn't call it an aspiration. He would call it a lie. But the naivete, and actually it shows that he's really just an apologist for the imperial power, that he would take it as a statement of aspiration, take it seriously and think that...
Well, and also the ethnocentrism of only respecting his own.
As
there are, as we agree, there's armies all over the world have these codes. So why not spread it around and say, well, everybody believes, according to these codes, that we ought not to harm civilians.
Yeah. But also to make a statement like that in the midst of a war where civilians have been killed on a really huge scale, and we're actually... there's a lot of. He says that also the Marines, as compared to Vietnam, where the Vietnamese were called gooks and slopes and so on, the modern Marines don't do that. But how does he know that? I mean, this,
yes.
He would make a statement like that. In fact, there have been newspaper articles indicating that American soldiers frequently have talked about Iraqis as sand niggers,
yeah,
and as hajis, and they've had a lot of nasty terms. He's not even right in his ability to read a newspaper. The newspapers have indicated that the soldiers have a lot of contempt for. It's completely incomprehensible, too, that here's a new culture where people are threatening them, that they would despise these different people. Mm-hmm. It's completely plausible. But here he takes the heat.
Well, he is a good debater, but I shouldn't call him a good one. He's a predictable one. His game is that if you point out something, like the killing yesterday, the massacre of the Afghanistan civilians, which nobody's going to now dispute, he'll say, well, that's an anecdote.
Yeah.
With him, anything that's a contradictory thesis, he calls it an anecdote.
Yeah.
Well, we've been speaking to Professor Edward Herman. I wonder just, I guess, lastly, let's place this book. What do you think of the value of this book?
Well, I think this is a really terrible book. I mean, it's a big, fat, pretentious thing with many footnotes and tables and so on, but it's so manipulative, and it's completely refutable, and he makes a amazing series of these absurd statements, like this statement on the aspirations of the Marines, the Vietnamese responsible for their own deaths from America. I mean, there's a stream. As I read this book, I was amazed. I had thought that Pinker, being a Harvard professor and so on, would put up a respectable performance. But I found that there is probably a misstatement or a misleading statement in every other paragraph in the book. We're working on a larger study of the Pinker with David Peterson. And the problem is we're inundated with material. There's so much to refute. Table after table is loaded with bias and misrepresentations. I think it's a despicable book. Yeah. But I think the reason it's so successful, as we said earlier, is that it really serves the imperial needs beautifully. I compared it with this book by Claire Sterling back in 1981 called The Terror Network. Right at the beginning of the Reagan administration, they were looking for some rationale to attack the evil empire. And here along comes Claire Sturley with a book, The Terror Network, that ties it all to the Soviet Union. It was an absolutely terrible book. It was a terrible book, but it was well reviewed and it was taken seriously.
I remember that.
And here comes Pinker with now saying that in spite of all these appearances of violence and so on, and wars and proposed wars, it's an age of a great peace, a long peace, and violence is declining. I mean, it's a beautiful propaganda cover for a permanent war system.
Yeah, that's very good. We are back at Orwell's War is Peace.
Yeah, that's about it.
Well, Edward Herman, we are very grateful for the time. It's a great article, and I think for me, the best thing that's come out of the book is that the article you and David Peterson and your work are doing in response to it. I hope and I know that there's going to be people turning to what you have to say. Thanks very, very much.
Okay, thank you, Phil.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Edward Herman, and he's at the University of Pennsylvania, Professor Emeritus in Communications. And again, I'll remind you, together with Noam Chomsky, wrote one of the classic books, Manufacturing Consent, which, by the way, their title was taken from Walter Lippmann, a kind of a ruling class puppy who explained how you set the line for the population. You manufacture consent. We'll take a quick break and come back, and Phil's going to read you something about Julius Caesar.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto, presenting the history and evolution of sound for 25 years and counting. CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
I told you we'd be back. By the way, write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. That's taylor@ciut.fm. Check us out on the web at taylor-report.com, where you get our interviews with gentlemen such as Edward Herman. And Phil, the Ides of March are upon us. And you have a book want to read for
Well, it is one of my favorite books. First, I learned about it on the Taylor Report about 8 or 9 years ago. The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome by Michael Parenti. I never understood Rome or anything about it until I read this book. And then I realized, well, of course, I couldn't possibly understand anything about Rome because the only people who wrote about it at the time, the only contemporaries, they all had a fish to fry and they all had masters to satisfy, right? And those masters were the landowners, the senators, the people who oppressed the citizens of what was a very large urban center. The thesis of Parenti is, of course, that the assassination of Julius Caesar was not just an ordinary power struggle, but that Julius Caesar was a serious social reformer. He was of their class. He was not proposing to end class rule, but what he was proposing is to have political reforms that would have ameliorated the misery of the soldiers and the slaves and the allegedly free artisans of Rome, and that he had to die for this. And I just thought I would read this little passage in case any of our listeners are in Rome or will be in Rome on Thursday the 15th. Make your way to the forum, and this is what he has to say, actually, at the end of his narrative. Today in modern Rome, amidst the ruins of the forum, there stands the temple of Julius Caesar, reputedly built upon the very site where his earthly remains had been burned. Indeed, it seems centrally situated in the forum, just where Caesar's body would most likely have been placed. The temple is a modest one-story structure composed of the dark, narrow bricks that were the common building material of the Republic's public edifices. It is said that the ashes of Caesar's pyre still rest somewhere beneath the structure. To this day, every year on the 15th of March, numerous bouquets of flowers are left at the temple entrance by persons unknown. And
To this day.
I mean, the people of Rome, of course, have, when we talk about historical memory, they really have historical memories, which dwarfs what we have here. And what he's telling us is that there is a culture among the common people of Rome where it is passed down orally for centuries, you know, for millennia, that this was a guy who wanted to give us a break. and he paid for, prayed for it with his life, right? Yeah. Anyway, this The Assassination of Julius Caesar by Michael Parenti, one of the most outstanding books I've ever read on history, and I recommend it highly.
Yeah, it is a terrific book. By the way, I remember when we interviewed him, it's got a very striking cover. I don't know. I know you can't judge a book by its cover, but if you were to judge one by its cover, this has got a great cover. Yeah. It is Caesar, but it's just the way it's done. It's very striking.
Yeah.
But we have a couple of three other items to talk about. I want to make mention, and everybody's seen this viral thing on it's called Kony 2012. I have some experience with this from having worked in Africa and on the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and I was aware and heard a lot about Mr. Kony and others, and really that's where I'd put the stress. This is bizarre that a young middle-class white guy from San Diego.
Who poses with a Kalashnikov in his arms, right?
He and his pals with guns. But not only are they holding the guns, but they're standing with members of the Sudanese South Liberation Army, which has quite a reputation, not a good one. And as a matter of fact, I would ask him, show me an army in that region that doesn't have child soldiers. Show me one.
Including that one he's standing with.
He's standing with. Yeah. Those guys they are notorious. I mean, actually, people should know, you know, after everybody went over and declared the new government of South Sudan, and the first thing they did was begin to kill each other because they're all struggling to be the boss because there's going to be a lot of money made if you're the one who can sell the oil to South Sudan. And so they're at each other's throat. Well, this involves Mr. Kony's people of the northern Uganda. He's from that population, and they're on both sides of the border, Sudan and Uganda. He is particularly charged because of his role in what has been a guerrilla war for going back for decades, So for these people to pretend that somehow it was going to add or detract, they're not going to do anything other than to make it easier for the White House in Washington to involve itself in Central Africa because he's calling on them to help him, and he's going to help them. So it's like they have this great joint criminal enterprise between them. And it's been pointed out, actually, the particular guerrilla group, and there are dozens of them, but this one has been driven out of Uganda at the moment. They are actually, they're said to be in Congo. He forgets that this is, again, one side in a conflict. The other side, the one that is attacking him, led by President Museveni, has a long criminal record involving two invasions of Congo where heinous crimes were carried out. Now, he was aligning himself with them. I mean, this is all just silly. We need to get very serious about what is at stake in this situation because the government of Uganda has invaded Congo. The government of Rwanda has invaded Congo. And when they got there, they actually fought each other once. Because they were in a diamond-rich area, and they were trying to decide who would be the dominant invading army.
And we should also remember that Museveni had his hand in the horrific events in Rwanda, in the sense that he nurtured and protected.
Of course, a section of his army invaded Rwanda. Yeah. They were his soldiers. Paul Kagame, president of Rwanda, was once a general in the army of Mr. Museveni. These are more interesting, important facts for people to know rather than a fairy tale with a five-year-old white kid who's applauding his father for wanting to capture an African. Capturing Africans, by the way, ought to really put up a kind of a caution sign when you hear that somebody wants to do that or to kill them. I would tell you that he is not an authority on any crimes alleged against Mr. Kony. He wouldn't know. He's heard stories. But I'm telling him there are plenty of other stories. So he's decided to particularize this one. I was struck when I learned that he had given a lecture at Liberty University. That's Mr. Falwell's, as I recall, university. And the only other notable lecturer was Michelle Bachmann, the extreme right-wing candidate for the Republican Party leadership. I shouldn't say she was the only. There were a number of such people. They don't invite liberals. And what he had to say there was a little chilling. He obviously is some kind of an evangelical tie-in. But, you know, when people decide to become vigilantes, any proper sheriff or police chief or policeman would say, you know, you're a criminal. If you show up with a gun and tell me you're going to go into a neighborhood looking for a bad person, I'm going to arrest you. Because who deputized you? And this whole propaganda film is a deputizing deal where he wants actually millions of people to become his fellow undeputized vigilantes. They're going to go and catch the bad guy. And vigilantes are always worse than what they think they're going to solve. And it might take us back to Mr. Pinker. Because there's an idea that white civilization is going to go and correct the Africans. And so it's a very poisonous thing. And everybody ought to be fighting back against it. There's another important matter we want to make sure we talk about, I think, is that Gaza has been attacked again, and Hillary Clinton attacked the Gazans. Now, meanwhile, over in Syria, she wants to arm people who are using armed resistance against the central government of Syria. She says, oh, well, we have to do, you know, something has to be done about this terrible government. Well, who's making these aerial assaults on the people of Gaza? And why do we accept what they have to say? In the case of Syria, she paints anybody with a gun as a good person. In the case of the Palestinians, they're bad. I saw Mr. Kaburi, a professor at McMaster University, made a nice point the other day. He says, well, the Arabs are always, you treat them with a stick. Everybody else, you talk about carrots. But when it comes to us, it's a stick. Well, that's particularly true of the Palestinians. And I noticed that when an attack like this one happens in Gaza, we have a NDP leadership race, and I know it's not a word to say. I mean, this is just, we're talking about political bankruptcy. And well, the people who don't really want to lead Canadians. Canadians need to know, what is this all about? And does anybody have any useful things to contribute? They have a useful thing to contribute. They all sit and say, oh, we're for a two-state solution. We're for negotiated settlement. We call on, you know, calm on all sides. Well, okay, so that's not an answer. We have, because we have assaults on Libya, bombing of Libya. Now we know 7,500 missions or something, bombing missions against Libya to put somebody in power. We have black Libyans being persecuted, brutalized, killed, etc. And we have, according to the Ottawa Citizen, evidence that we connived at that. So the NDP, the Liberal Party, Conservative Party, Bloc too, all lied to us when they said, oh, it's a no-fly zone. No, it was an attack zone. You were involved in regime change. So you've all lied. I'd like them all to explain why they lied to us, since it's now known they did lie. When are we going to get some leadership on that front? And none. There is a conspiracy of silence amongst our ruling parties. They don't. They've all said, I'm not going to talk about it. And the other guy says, neither am I. So, you know, the Canadian people are left with nothing in terms of elected leaders. Nobody. The only one that did do anything was a Green Party leader, and she voted against the extension of the mission. She hasn't said much lately, but by the way, she becomes still the most outstanding individual for having done that much. So we have a rather serious matter there. And, of course, we've all heard about the Afghanistan thing. I can remember when Don Cherry took the Stanley Cup over, and so it was Afghanistan Stanley Cup, and with Don Cherry. And then we had the Toronto Star, had all of its ace correspondents, they go over, and they said, isn't this wonderful? And they talked about what the tea tastes like and how the women feel liberated. Well, now we're urinating on dead people and burning their Qurans and then occasionally going out and slaughtering people in villages. When are they going to tell us that they lied to us? Either that or that they're so damn dumb that they shouldn't be involved in leadership. And one other thing. I mean, we're near the end here, but the 500 civilian deaths in Syria, they do not know that. as has been pointed out, when they're questioned, the UN source for that, they don't have any on-site sources. They collect what they hear, and then they tell us that. So given how ugly the situation is, we should be supremely skeptical about all the reports from these places. Anyhow, this Phil Conlon, thanks very much. Carol, thank you. This is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report, and we'll see you next week.